Before I begin, I wanted to start by acknowledging the traditional landowners of the or the custodian of the land we're gathering on today, and pay my respect to elders past and present and any emerging leaders among us today. I thought perhaps today I would start by taking you through a journey, or get you through a journey where you can try to imagine a bit of my story. And if I may ask you to either close your eyes or bow your head down for a minute and just try to imagine some of the words that are things that I'm telling you. Imagine yourself as a young boy or a girl growing up in a small village. Imagine you are wandering around the village with other children playing, giggling, happy. Imagine your parents telling you to stop going out and hang out with friends and other kids. No explanation whatsoever. The joy you had stopped all of a sudden. Imagine your village is attacked by gunmen. Imagine you hear the gunshots, children crying, and women crying for help. Imagine the whole village on fire. You can hear fire rattling. You can smell the smoke. Imagine you woke up confronted by the scene of what had happened the previous day. Imagine you are forced to leave your village. Imagine walking in the forest. You can hear lions and other animals. Imagine you've gone days without food and water. And now imagine yourself as a young boy being trained as a soldier. Imagine yourself right at the front line, fighting. Now imagine you are on the plane, heading to Australia. You can open your eyes now. Friends, I am one of the lucky. I feel I'm very, very lucky. Until today, sometime when I stand here, I feel like I would like to pinch myself to see that I'm not dreaming, because I still have the memories of the years I spent in the camp. I remember very clearly my village was attacked, and I remember my mother pushing us under the bed, and she was praying and chanting. And I can hear people crying outside, women and children. Helplessly, I did not understand what was happening, but it was a horrific scene. And I remember I can feel my mother breathing and her worry that is transferred to us as kids. I did not know that we would live to see tomorrow. The following morning, as a young boy, of course, I wanted to rush outside and go and play with my friends. But then I was confronted by the scene of what had happened the previous night. People had everything as gone. We were very lucky our hut was spared. And I remember running back, trying to find my mother so that she can tell me exactly what had happened. And my mother at the time looked at me and said, "David, this is the reason why I told you earlier you need to start coming home early." For me, my life was turned upside down immediately then. My father works in a different village, so when the attack happened in my village, he was not around. A few days later, he came. And I spotted my father from far. I was very excited, so I ran towards him. And I remember my father pushing me aside and asked, "David, where's your mother?" I pointed to where my mother was, and my father walked over to her, and they started a conversation. And as they talked, I realized something was not right. because I sense they were arguing literally there. And both walked towards me. My mother came towards me and she hugged me. Because my father was in a rush and I could, his voice just came through and said, David, let's go. And both my mother and dad, one holding one hand, the other holding the other hand, and both almost pulling me to different directions. And my mother let go of my hands as my father dragged me away. As I walked away, I stood for the last time to take a look, and I could see my mother standing there, and she was crying. As my father dragged me away, that began the journey, my journey as a war child and as a refugee child. My father told me, David, I'm taking you on a journey where you will go and find everything you need. And as a kid, that was enough for me to hear. I was very happy. I never got a chance in my village to go to school or kinder or anything like that. So my life, basically, I was growing up, I did not know what else I could do in the village. But as children, we made up of our activities, going into the forest every day and find food, hunt birds and insects, and that pretty much was our life. So when my father said there's another better life than this, where I'm taking you, I was very pleased. And so we started on a journey. No trains, no buses, nothing. And so we had to walk. When we left, we did not carry anything. I was wearing my short T-shirt, and though I didn't have any shoes. And so day one, I was pretty happy. Day two, day three, and the kids here today will know when you are going on a journey with your family, you ask the famous question, are we there yet? I indeed ask the same question, Dad, when are we going to arrive? My father will turn to me and say, David, we'll be there tomorrow. And so that day I'll walk really hard knowing that tomorrow will be our final destination. Then when tomorrow's come, we're still walking. I've asked that question a lot of time. I worked it out that my father was really trying to encourage me to keep going, but I literally didn't know when are we going to arrive to our final destination. We cut through the bush. We crossed streams and rivers, invested with crocodiles. We will stop everywhere. Wherever we stop, the likes of my father will go into the bush and hunt wild animals, whatever they will get, and that's basically what we eat. And it was a very, very hard journey. I was very lucky my father was with me. But other children who came along, as South Sudan, lots of villages were attacked, everyone left and children unaccompanied. So my father was with me along the journey. As a kid, as we walk, I can see, you know, people lying on the footpath, and I'll turn to my father, Dad, what are they doing? And my father will turn to me and say, David, they're resting and they will follow us later. But that wasn't the case, of course. My father was playing a father's role in trying to protect me from what was happening. But we kept going every day. Eventually, I never asked a question. I cried until I cried no more. I felt the pain until I felt no more pain. My feet blisters, you can imagine, 40 degrees sun every day, feet, you know, pain, bleed, everything. And so eventually we arrived in Ethiopia. And that was the 3 months later we were told, this is your home. Imagine, I was about 6 or 7 years old then. When we arrived after 3 months walk, not everybody made it, of course. Now, I turned and looked at my father because he said, you'll find everything you need when we arrive. So I confirmed again and said, Dad, are we here now? My father said, yes, we have arrived, finally. And I looked around, it was just bush. And this, we were told, this is going to be your home. And as a child, of course, my life was then is sort of really turned upside down. And by this time, I had to adapt to the situation, to the new environment. A few days later, the likes of my father were trained, taken away, and off they went to war. At that time, war in South Sudan was very, very active at the time. So here we were, left children alone, no one looking after us. We had to find food, build our own huts, do everything for ourselves. We had to survive. Before my father left, he knelt down beside me and said, "David, you're a grown-up man." And I was about 8 years old. "You're a grown-up man, look after yourself." And indeed, that's what I did. With other colleagues, we looked after ourselves, did everything we would do. And life wasn't quite easy at the first. At first, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees did not hear what had happened to these kids, or did not hear that there are masses of young people that crossed the border to Ethiopia. So it was really, really difficult moment for us at the time. And so for me, I was just hoping that someone or anyone will turn out and help. But it was quite difficult at the time. We spent about 6 months, really, where we didn't have food or clean water. 6 months where we struggled. We would drink from the river that was running across or alongside our camp, where we'd drink and wash. And all of a sudden, a massive cholera outbreak, and not many people made it. And we keep praying every day that someone will come to our rescue. But eventually, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees turned up, and wow, there was food there now. And there's medical, there's all that. But during the day, the camp was a refugee camp. But at night, the camp was completely different at night. At night, every month, we'll stand on the parade, and people will be picked. You know, and some of you have met South Sudanese before, they're very tall, and I'm very short. So when we stand on the parade, I'm very lucky, this tiny David there, you know, the tall people get picked and they go to the front line. But I remember I would sit there and I'd cry and I'd say, why not me? Because I knew that's where I wanted to go. There was nothing else we did in the camp. Finally, when I was about 11, 12 years old, my turn came. And that was the happiest moment of my life, really. Taken to the military training camp, trained, 6 months of drills, and then we got out. And I remember as children standing on the parade, and you're given an AK-47, and you are told, "This is your mother, this is your father." And indeed, you can imagine what kids would do when you are given such a toy. We called them toy back then, and it was horrific. I survived the war, of course, and not many of my friends did. And our base camp was attacked, so we had to walk and cross another border. And this time, we crossed the border to Kenya. At the border, because the Kenyan government said, before you cross the border to Kenya, you have to disarm. Of course, not all of us were happy to do that, but reluctantly we did, and we started a camp, Kakuma Refugee Camp, northern part of Kenya. That became my home for 12 years. 12 years of hardship, 12 years of one meal a day, 12 years of just being there and not knowing what to do, 12 years of not knowing what will happen to you tomorrow. But eventually in 2000, the American government came with a resettlement process and said, "We are going to take you to America." Of course, at first we were very reluctant because we knew nothing about America. And so for some of us, we thought America would mean, perhaps America means we're going to end up at the front line. So people were a little bit reluctant. But the first batch of friends, a small airplane landed in the airstrip in the camp. They went through the process and off they left to Nairobi, and then they disappeared. Months later, we never heard from them. And eventually we worked it out, they went to America. But at first, everyone was very reluctant. And the routine is simple. You go to the notice board every day, you wait for your name or see your name, and against that, there will be countries that will welcome you or take you. America took the largest number, Canada, New Zealand, and then Australia. For 4 years, I walked to the notice board trying to see my name. I went there, and then at the time, I would give up, you know. But one day my friend came running and said, "David, I saw your name." I was really very happy. So I went there, and of course I thought, I'm going to America, but it's Australia, and I thought, oh, okay, that's still fine. Knew nothing about Australia. And I did all my process. You go and tell your story to someone, you go through medical checkup, and then eventually you come back and you are flown from the camp, and that's what Americans were doing, and off you go. So the routine was quite straightforward, and everybody knew what would happen. After you finish all the process, you know the next step. And we will come always on the airstrip. Friends who will leave will come, bring them to the airstrip, they get into the plane, and off they leave. Now, I wasn't told much about Australia. You know, they've said a few things, I wasn't really listening properly, but I knew. One thing they said was Australia was cold. And I thought, cold, okay. So I worked it out that in the camp, sometimes it's 40 degrees. When it's about 30 or 25 degrees, then I say it's cold. So no one really told me the meaning of cold. So I sort of reluctantly, in that orientation class, I didn't listen really well. I was eager to go to Australia. And so came the day that we were leaving. We were told a place where we could meet, and off we went to that place, I mean, where we would gather. And this time it was different. America, remember I said, once you finish all your process of check, there is a small airplane that lands in the airstrip in the camp, and off you leave. But this time when we were told to go to where we were meeting, we arrived quite early in the morning, of course, very excited and happy, heading to our new country, and there, 12 minibuses standing there. And we looked around at each other, and one guy turned and said, "Where is that Australia again?" And I thought, wow. So I start to imagine how poor Australia is. American come with a small plane and you are sending us minibuses. And that was quite incredible. Anyway, but the faith and the hope, we said, let's try it. We got into the bus. And I want you to imagine 850 kilometers drive from Kakuma to Nairobi, where we'll connect to the next plane. No one was talking to one another. It was really horrific journey. But again, we hang on to our faith, and we arrived in Nairobi, spent a night, and then the following day we driven to the airport, Jomo Kenyatta International Airport. And there, that's when we began to have a bit of faith in Australia, because the plane we saw was a massive big plane compared to what was coming into the camp. And off my years, 12 years in Kakuma, 5 years in Ethiopia, I was sitting on the plane knowing that this is it for me, that I will go to a place where I'll eat 3 meals a day, I'll have plenty, I'll sleep without hearing gunshot, I will never worry. And on the 3rd of August 2004, four of us were on the plane coming to Australia. And for me, there were so many things in my head at the time while coming. I was trying to plan my life even before I arrived in Australia. Of course, part of it is I want to eat as much as I can, and I want to do everything that I haven't done as a kid. But part of me too, I grew up with the faith, and I used to pray in the camp, and I say, God, if ever you give me an opportunity to go to a better place, I'll make sure that no one else goes through what I've gone through. Somehow, part of my brain, I say, I want it, once I get to Australia, I want to make a difference, and that's what I want to do. So after we arrived, I was wearing my short, I was with my slippers and my t-shirt, and it's August in Melbourne. And so we got down from the plane and I thought, oh, it's all right. You know, it's not that cold. But I didn't know that we came straight from the plane through the terminal. So there was heating system, but I didn't work that hard. So I thought it wasn't that bad, really. So we just kept going. I arrived at the migration with my paper, travel document, which the migration guy looked at it, smiled and said, "Welcome, David," and stamped. And that was the beginning, really, for me. As I followed people out, it was quite amazing. I was just having a feel of my new home as I left the airport. Coming through, seeing so many white people, like, wow, this is great, you know, for me. So I just kept going, following people. And, of course, while I was wandering around, I came to this one place where everyone was standing. And then the bags started coming around on this thing that goes in like a belt and come out. And I thought, wow, this is great. This is my new home. You know, there's a lot of stuff that I'm seeing. Of course, I learned later that it's called carousel. I had to find that out quite immediately. But I liked that feeling. As I walked out again, I was told when we left that at the end, when you get the final exit, there will be people that will meet you. And my friends have heard that I was coming, so they're friends that the way we were in the camp together, and my cousin, they were all there, who like my sponsors and waiting outside with the social worker. So the first door, first set of doors, the doors that open by themselves, that's cool, it's open. I walked through them, and as I kept going, I met my friends that I grew up with, my cousin, who have sponsored us to come out, and then we head out. And the last door, set of doors opened again, and now I was greeted by the cold breeze of Melbourne. Hit my face and I ran back in. And for me, that basically the introduction of my life in Australia. Going up, we were driven to our flats, Brunswick Street, Fitzroy, for those of you who might have gone there. I still remember on the 11th floor, going up the lift, and we were shown, this is your home, this is your bed, this is the fridge, and we introduced everything. And that, for me, was the moment I nearly broke down, because I could not believe that now there's a bed for me and there's enough food for me. And that was a really tough journey, basically. So I sat there. I remember the first 3 nights, I could not sleep, literally. For me, I was taking in everything that was happening around me. But it turned out to be quite amazing for me in such a life. The following morning, I walked up, and I wanted to have a walk outside and see my new home, because we arrived at night, and I told my cousin and my friend, I said, I want to take a walk. And as I walk, you know, Brunswick Street, people, the first person I saw passed me, of course there were so many others, someone smiled at me. I was like, okay, that's new. The second person, they smiled again. The third person, they smiled, and I thought, wow, either there's something wrong with me, or this country is really, really good then. I even went a little bit on the side to look at myself and see whether I've dressed terribly. But this is how generous and how nice people are. And another thing happened during that journey too. This black fella walked towards me, and he said, welcome, brother, this is your home. I looked at him and I thought, you're right. For me, I did not understand the history of this country, something that was omitted when we were told about Australia. And I worked it out, so I went back and I asked my cousin, who had been in Australia for a bit, and he said, oh, those are the Aborigines. And I thought, who are they? And then he started telling me their story, really. For me, it was quite amazing, that encounter. So my life, after I've arrived, 11 months of learning English, thank you. That's amazing to do stuff. Because one of the challenges of refugees when they arrive is the language. And once you get the language, then other things follow. So English was really tough. I thought I knew English, because when I came, when I'm asked, I say, yes, I speak English. But when I arrived, your English was completely different English. I could not hear what you would say. But I learned English 11 months, and then eventually I was told you will go to university. Now, imagine as a young kid who have never gone to school before, the little school I had is sitting under the tree, and then coming to Melbourne, and I learn a bit of English, and I'm told you're going to university. That is unreal for me, because I know the process is that in Africa, it doesn't matter where, not Africa altogether, but in South Sudan, because of many years of war, it doesn't matter how old you are, you start grade 1, class 2, and you go, primary, secondary. And so when I finished and I was told, David, you are good enough to go to university, it was quite incredible. Could not believe it, but eventually I put in my application, got a scholarship, went to University of Melbourne, and boy, the first semester or the first year, I failed terribly. I reached a point where I wanted to give up. But there's something in me that never give up. And I worked hard, and I worked hard, and I worked hard. Eventually, I finished my degree, and that basically defines what I do. In 2007, I finally decided to say, where are my parents? And so I tracked down my father quite easily through friends, And I was able to connect with my father. He passed away now, but back then I managed to speak to my father. My father went back during the war, survived the war, went back, tried to find my mother. He was not able to find my mother, where we left my mother in the village. So he remarried and went on. So when I found my dad, we were talking, my dad said, "I'm sorry, but I don't know where your mother is." That became very hard for me to take, really. Because I really wanted, by then it's like over 20 years without seeing my mother. And that was really painful. But finally one day a phone call came through and Dad said, "I found your mother." And the next day I was on the plane heading back to meet my mother. And it was just quite an incredible scene, just that reunification with my family. And so now, after going back and see the poverty or the level where my parents or family are and the whole community, that began to define who I am and what I would do. I remember my prayer, "God, if ever you go to a better place, I'll make sure that no one else goes through what I've gone through." And basically I came back to Australia and I say, "I gotta make a difference." I knew while in the years, 17 years in a refugee camp, someone was clothing me, somebody was providing food, somebody was doing all that. And I thought the best way to give back and to say thank you is really to make a difference. And that defined my work. So people, the Quakers, for instance, recently sent me to Switzerland to go and study and to go and help. Not in particular anything, just to do a course on national dialogue and mediation where I could go back with those skills and help in my country. I'm heavily, heavily involved in the designing of the national reconciliation in South Sudan, where I travel back and forth now. But now I call Melbourne home, have a daughter. She's born in Australia, 10 years old, and a son, 5 months old. And friends, I'll leave it here, and I'm happy to welcome questions, Ian. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for sharing your story with us tonight, David. It's very valuable and powerful. There is an opportunity for the audience to ask you questions. I perhaps have one question to get us started. This map, your story, I'm perhaps asking you to do the impossible and perhaps the little bit crazy, but can you explain the war for us, the conflict that was happening in your country, who you were fighting for, who the opposition were, what was this crazy situation you were in the middle of?
So Sudan, the big red, was one big country, Sudan. And then we had two sets of conflict that began in 1956, ended in 1972. The second phase of the conflict began in 1983 and ended in 2005. And I was caught up in that second phase of the war. That's the main reason of the war. There were two reasons. Religion. I come from South, predominantly Christians, and the North, predominantly Muslims. And so religion was a big part of what was happening as a reason for the conflict. The second one basically was the resources that are all found in the south part of the country. And so those were two main reasons that caused the war. Now, we fought for that many years. And in 2011, peace was signed in 2005. And 2011, we voted and became a nation, 194th. Member of United Nations. That was pretty good. We celebrated quite happy. But we, as rebel or as a movement, we never had the experience of running a country. So when we became a country ourselves, it wasn't long before we started fighting each other. So now the conflict that has ended about 6 years ago is a tribal conflict between, the conflict began as the political differences between the big two guys that spread very quickly into tribal war, and that's where we are. So now, peace was signed last year in September, and we have a timeline where we are working towards. In November, 11th of November, we will form a government of national unity, bringing all the warring factions together to form that government of national unity. So that's what is happening.
Is your country learning the lessons of previous wars, of bringing those warring factions together? Is there something that's happening at the moment that sets your country up for success?
At the moment, really, the role that the South Sudanese diaspora are playing are quite really important, because we've seen both sides. We've experienced the war, and then we've come to the West and also experienced how good life is. And so the skills that we've learned here, we try to take that back in South Sudan. And I think as well, we've reached war fatigue. People are tired fighting for years. And so hopefully the current peace, hopefully it will hold, and so that we can now concentrate in development and getting people just to live in harmony.
Mm-hmm. One last question for me. Do you think you'll go back? Is Australia your home now, or will that pull of a peaceful country be too much for you?
No, I go back all the time. I already this year I've been back twice, mm-hmm. and on the 28th I'll be back there again. So there's a whole lot of work that I do there back in South Sudan that I support. So, but I call this place, I call Australia my home because my family are here. I still feel, or not feel, I know I'm a refugee, but I know my daughter and my son, they are not refugees, but and so this is their home, basically, and I will be here to support them until they grow up. Mm-hmm.